From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the shape of Texas politics to come. The shakeup in the Alabama special election could foreshadow some surprises in the midterms, even in Texas.
There's suddenly a feeling in the air that both the House and the Senate are potentially in play.
How bringing back tourists to the Harvey-hammered coast is critical for the recovery, and observations from a Harvey homeless tent city. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The filing deadline has come and gone for Texas political candidates who are running in the 2018 midterms. Governor Greg Abbott is running for a second term in office. Senator Ted Cruz is also running for re-election. KERA's Christopher Connolly has more.
First, there's the primaries. Ted Cruz is facing a challenge from, among others, Bruce Jacobson, who's a Christian TV producer from North Richland Hills. In the general election, Democratic El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke began mounting his bid for Cruz's Senate seat months ago. He's been all over the state already, pitching himself as an outsider. Abbott has a Republican challenger as well, but he's widely expected to sail through the primary. For governor, there are a number of Democrats running, including Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez and Andrew White, who's the son of a former Texas governor, Mark White. The race is shaping up with White aiming to attract more moderate, more centrist Democrats, independents, and even Republicans. Valdez is making a play for more of the progressive wing of the party.
Texas Congressman Blake Farenthold will not be running for re-election in 2018. This comes amid growing allegations of sexual harassment and workplace abuse in Farenthold's office. The Corpus Christi Republican has held the seat since 2011. In recent weeks, it was revealed that the U.S. representative settled a sexual harassment case with a former staffer several years ago. That settlement cost taxpayers $84,000. In a video posted Thursday on Facebook, Farenthold said he allowed an unprofessional culture take root in his office.
It accommodated destructive gossip, offhand comments, off-color jokes, and behavior that in general was less than professional. And I allowed the personal stress of the job to manifest itself in angry outbursts, and too often a failure to treat people with the respect that they deserved. That was wrong.
Farenthold maintained that the allegations made in the suit filed by his former staffer were false, but he said the issue has become a political distraction and his constituents deserve better. For more on what the 2018 midterms hold for Texas, we turn to Harvey Kronberg, editor of the Quorum Report. He said the Alabama special election for senator this week that elected Democrat Doug Jones over Republican Roy Moore does have implications for Texas and the nation.
There is a possibility, although it obviously is to a large degree is candidate dependent. One reporter characterized it on election night. It was the revolt of the suburbs, which have traditionally been Republican strongholds. But college-educated women, in particular, have been essentially defecting from the Republican Party. The lesson was learned from the Clinton campaign about not taking a minority vote for granted. It depends to a large degree on the ground game, along with turnout among the college-educated white women in Texas. A candidate needs to be a centrist. So a Bernie Sanders-style candidate probably would not be effective, but center-left would at least have a possibility.
It seemed like after the 2016 election, a lot of the leading Democrats were obsessed with trying to attract the Trump voter and make them Democrats. And that's not what they tried in Alabama. It was a candidate who stuck to his pro-choice views. And came across as a solid, a moderate liberal, which for them is a radical liberal. And they appealed to the traditional Democratic base, which is going out for voters of color. And it seemed to have worked. And so I'm wondering, have these big thinkers, the pointy heads of the Democratic Party, have they said, well, this is the model to follow?
Well, again, it would be with select candidates. So, for instance, I would suspect that Ted Cruz has lower positive numbers here in Texas than Greg Abbott or Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. That was the turnout model. In a general election, though, pollsters tell me that Texas has about 60% that really don't give a damn about abortion one way or the other, a typical general election voter. So it's not a driving issue the way it might have been in Alabama. But against the context of the sexual allegations, obviously there were other forces at work.
But Alabama has a larger percentage of your traditional pro-Trump voter?
Nationally, it's about 57% are pro-choice. Alabama is about 57% pro-life.
And some people are wondering, Texas could be a better fit for the model if they actually had the right candidates that would appeal towards minority voters who have been unenthusiastic in the past.
Exactly. And interestingly, if you look at Houston has been pretty solidly Democratic with Lupe Valdez, the Dallas sheriff Latina running for governor. It has suddenly made any number of races up in North Texas and the Metroplex competitive that weren't previously competitive. It could have a ripple effect if she ends up being the Democratic candidate.
So I want to get to Lupe Valdez in a second, but do you think that there were some Democrats who were thinking about running and didn't run for on a statewide ballot in 2018, and then after they saw the Alabama-Bama, they may have been going, I missed the bus.
I think there probably is a buyer's remorse on not having filed.
I'm thinking of like Joaquin Castro.
Of course.
And then maybe Julian Castro running for governor.
That's correct. I'm not sure. I mean, they're pretty risk averse when everything is said and done. So, or they've proven to be pretty risk averse when everything is said and done. But I think there is an opportunity that they missed this time, because President Trump has galvanized one group of voters nationally. Although we rarely expect any national commitment to Texas from the Democratic Party, it's just too expensive. If you were able to increase Hispanic and African American participation by 5 to 10%, it could be transformative.
But we do have Lupe Valdez. She's running for governor, although she has primary opponents. Is he kind of seen as the front runner, and does that just make her the head lamb to the slaughter?
Well, it kind of depends on the position she takes, but she's been popular in Dallas County, but she's also a 70-year-old gay Latina.
Is that too much to ask for Texas?
I am reluctant to predict how that plays in a state like Texas, and it may be too big a trade-off, the possibility of increasing Hispanic participation.
But you never know.
Yep. It's an intriguing mix now, all of a sudden, as the Democratic Party nationally is coming back to life, as the suburbs, which have been the exclusive domain of the Republican Party, suddenly look competitive. I think it's not just statewide. I think there's probably some remorse among down-ballot possibilities. We're at the end of the redistricting cycle, so the lines that were drawn to be overwhelmingly Republican a decade ago, or nearly a decade ago, have degraded to a large degree. Millennials, women and minorities have apparently all been mobilized if what we've seen in Alabama and Virginia prove to continue going forward.
So along that action line, we have seen the Democratic Party, they have more challengers across the state than we would typically see. There are some, state rep seats that didn't find challengers, and I think there's just one state senator seat that doesn't have a Democratic challenger, but all of the congressional seats have challengers. So they're hoping that there's going to be a blue wave to ride. Will that make a difference?
I think everybody has revised for the Texas House, has revised the number of the prospects for Democrats. Previously, we were looking at maybe an increase of 6. Now we're looking at an increase of 10, which suddenly gives them leverage that they didn't previously have, brings them back to the table. While we're having this conversation, we shouldn't forget that the Republican primary is also very, very active, and that we have the culture wars and social conservatives versus the business community manifesting itself in any number of races. And for instance, It's entirely possible that two or three of the lieutenant governor's team, Republican team, could go down in the Republican primary. That would change the character of the Republican caucus in the Senate dramatically.
And we're seeing a challenge with Land Commissioner George Bush, George P. Bush.
Correct.
And there is a cultural war aspect to that challenge, because it's going to be all about the Alamo with the former holder of that office, Jerry Patterson.
He's not a very good fundraiser, relatively speaking, but he's got a great bumper sticker issue.
So it's about the Alamo?
Again, this is the Republican primary, and what drives Republican primary voters, the name Bush doesn't have the cachet it once did in Texas.
This Alamo issue, I think, is interesting because it seems that George P. Bush at the GLO, they were leading the restoration and reforming of the Alamo, redesign of the Alamo, the way that it's presented in downtown San Antonio. They're buying up a lot of buildings, and plans are being put in place to try and think how to do that. And there are some people, Tea Party types, it seems, have been very critical of some of this action because they think that it's not going to be Texas enough. We're kind of be moving away from the Alamo myth and more towards the reality of the Alamo and what actually happened, and not just focusing on the battle of the Alamo, but what the Alamo was like over the many years that it's been there, fulfilling different kind of roles. And Jerry Patterson seems to be falling in line with saying we need to protect the myth of the Alamo. Is that what this race is going to be about?
That's probably going to be the marquee issue in that race, and it'll elevate that race to something that we probably haven't seen before. GLO is General Land Office's functions are not widely known, but I think that what works in Patterson's favor on this was the air of secrecy that about the original plans as they were being developed.
But when Jerry Patterson says George P. Bush gave the Alamo away to the UN, that's going to be something that could excite Republican primary voters.
Yeah, certainly a segment of Republican primary voters, unless we do see a wave of moderate coming back into the Republican primary.
We didn't get a challenger for Attorney General Ken Paxton in the Republican primary. And that's interesting because Ken Paxton is facing so many of his own legal issues. It seemed like he was damaged goods and that there was a lot of remorse about him being the Republican nominee last time around. What happened?
Yeah, frankly, that was surprising. It seems that he is vulnerable. He is tainted. We'll of course, see how the litigation works. I don't mean to condemn him until we...
But, I mean, he is facing criminal charges.
He is.
He is the only Republican on the ballot. If something should happen to him or this case between now and Election Day in November...
Oh, that I see where you were going with that. Yeah, absolutely. Then
they don't have a fallback plan.
And I don't know what the deadline is for putting somebody on the ballot, but it seems to me that the trial date, if I recollect correctly, is going to be after the primary. So the Republicans may well find themselves in a lurch. We may have our first Democratic statewide office holder, or the voters may not care if they've got a convicted criminal at the AG's.
The Republican Party should have kind of thought this through. Did they not? And they decided to roll the dice?
What? Well, let's remember that the Republican Party has been taken over, the actual party infrastructure has been taken over by the Trump wing of the party and is essentially financed by a handful of mega donors. And the mega donors have rallied around Paxton. Raising enough money to challenge him in the primary becomes questionable. Typically, the biggest contributors to an attorney general are in the legal profession, and they are very incumbent friendly because they have so much business in front of the AG's office. So there's probably a practical element to all of this, that if you looked at it, he still probably polls reasonably well among Republican primary voters, and he's got enough mega donor resources behind him to be a formidable financial opponent. And the only hope I think anybody would really have in trying to take him out would be if he were convicted of one or more of these criminal charges that he's facing.
There's Representative Blake Fahrenthold. Now we know that he is retiring, although he had announced 2 weeks ago that he is seeking re-election. Now he changed his mind. About five GOP primary opponents had lined up to take him on, and then there are several Democrats who are going to challenge him in his district. But after all these allegations of sexual impropriety and revelation that he used taxpayer money to settle one of those cases with a congressional aide, he was too damaged even to run in Texas.
Yes, that is a pretty traditional community that we're
the coastal Bend area, Corpus Christi, that area, all the way to Victoria.
Well, first of all, financial resources were not going to be available to him. Second, the party would not rally behind him. Especially that became especially clear after Alabama and the party, when Senator Shelby said he was going to write in a candidate rather than vote for the Republican due to sexual allegations. It became clear to him that he had no base of support that he could fall back on.
But there are policies that are being put in place in Washington, D.C. that are not popular. The new tax bill is not popular. Still a lot of questions about funding of CHIP, the Child's Health Insurance Program. People want that funded again. Net neutrality was just killed. That is an unpopular move. Will this add up to, will there be a cost to pay when we have the elections in 2018?
I do believe that we are on the cusp. We're not quite there yet, but we're on the cusp of a wave election. Approval rating for the Republicans in D.C. Is probably near an all-time low. And on the generic question, do you prefer Democrats versus Republicans, the most recent polling I've seen nationally has Democrats with a high single-digit lead over Republicans. Now, you know, with the miracle of modern gerrymandering, that doesn't necessarily translate into a different House of Representatives, but I think there's suddenly a feeling in the air that both the House and the Senate are potentially in play.
Harvey Kronberg is the founding editor of the Nonpartisan Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics. It's online at quorumreport.com. Hurricane Harvey obliterated much of the tourist economy for the Texas coastal bend, especially in Aransas County. Months after the storm, cities are struggling to rebuild without the usual influx of cash that tourism brings. Cities like Rockport, Fulton, and Port Aransas are usually destinations for soaking up the sun and surf while spending money and providing jobs. But as I saw recently, there is a feathery bright spot which could help bring back the snowbirds. At the Aransas National Refuge this morning, three gangly white birds are prodding the marsh with their long beaks.
Two parents and a young colt that was hatched this summer.
And they have an audience. Bird watchers peer through the shutter snaps of Zoom lenses, taking in a rare whooping crane performance.
And they came down to spend the winter here in the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge.
Pat White is a bird watcher who lives near Rockport.
Right now, they're just foraging for wolfberries. Right now, that's one of their main sources of food, blue crabs and wolfberries.
This is going to be really good.
Patty Berry traveled from St. Louis to see the whoopers.
I'm anticipating that we're going to see more whooping cranes than we have so far today and at closer range, and that's always good because we like the photography angle of it, too. So what our lenses can't get us, the boat hopefully will get us.
The endangered whooping crane is the tallest North American bird, and it's named for its distinctive whooping call.
Okay, two cranes, 2 o'clock, going back to front, right over the horizon. They're getting ready to fly over the levee. That's probably what those cranes were hollering at.
Skimmer Captain Tommy Moore leads today's tour and gives a play-by-play about the local environment, from the birds to the dolphins playing in the boat's wake.
There's 200 to 300 of these dolphins in the immediate bay system, according to state fisheries. They eat 5 to 10% of their...
But it's the whooping cranes that brings people from around the planet to Rockport. This is the only wild, migrating, reproducing flock of whoopers in the world. And Moore says they're doing well this year.
They look fat and happy to me. When we had that really bad drought, you could tell that their breastbones were sticking out. But yeah, these are looking real good.
That's some much-needed positive news for Rockport Mayor Charles Wax.
What drives my economy? It's tourism.
Wax recently told state lawmakers about Rockport's challenges attracting visitors after Hurricane Harvey.
Five drivers. The Fulton Mansion, Texas State Maritime Museum, the Rockport Center for the Arts, the Aquarium at Rockport Harbor, and the Bay Education Center. Of the five, two don't exist anymore.
The aquarium and the Rockport Center for the Arts were destroyed. The other attractions are damaged.
But if I had guests coming to town to visit those or to fish or to bird, all of my major hotels are still closed.
That lack of hotel rooms creates multiple problems for bringing back tourism. The most obvious, if visitors want to come, they'll have to stay in nearby communities like Corpus Christi. Then Rockport misses out on the hotel occupancy tax, which in turn is usually spent promoting the area as a tourism destination. On top of that,
my sales tax has disappeared. My property tax is forecast to be 35% lower next year.
Wax said the city will either have to cut back on services right when they're needed the most or raise property taxes. That's an added burden to the town's remaining struggling residents.
Great blue heron getting up, going over the...
Burdens people like skimmer captain Tommy Moore can't take on right now. He says since Hurricane Harvey, business has been way down.
It's just hard to really get a trip together, and right now we got to watch our expenses as well, so we've just kind of pulled trips slower and do fewer trips with more folks.
And this is what you'll typically see when you see whooping cranes in the wild. Now, a pair of adult whoopers is very territorial. They guard the territory of about a square mile.
Also on board this morning is 93-year-old Ray Little, known as the Dean of Texas Coastal Birding.
I studied the whooping cranes because we knew that they would be extinct within the next few years. So I have been very partial to the whooping cranes since 1940.
Little is credited with helping educate the public about the whoopers and helped build their numbers back up from about three dozen. Today, the local flock has reached over 300, which could serve as an inspiration for the town. If the whooping crane was able to come back from the brink, so too could Rockport. Many Texans know well the towns of Port A, Rockport, and Fulton. We've vacationed there. We've had adventures there. We recall our days on the coast with nostalgia. Maybe you still have a special seashell from your time there tucked away in a treasure box, as so it is with TPR commentator Yvette Benavides.
Growing up in Laredo on the U.S.-Mexico border, my family vacations to the Texas coastal bend were excursions to the edge of a vast gulf and expansive ocean, drawing me out of the insular spaces and routines of the long school year. My siblings and I peered out of the windows of my dad's camper as we chugged along the intercoastal highway. I envied the brother or sister who first called out, "La Huita," at the first sight of the waves beyond the window and the steel beams of the bridge we traversed. To smell the salt air was a Proustian experience each year, so familiar and too long since the last time. We were on our way to Port Aransas and the yearly getaway that meant long mornings at the beach, floating and swimming, and then reading comics and paperbacks in the shade of the camper at high noon when the sun was the most punishing. We picnicked on feasts of sandwiches and chips and Plaza brand sodas from H-E-B. Late afternoons, we were back on the beach, still wearing swimsuits that had since dried on our young bodies, everyone with salt-waved hair, combing the shore for seashells, building sandcastles, before we settled in to sit on towels and just watch the reliable, constant waves for hours before returning to the house where we stayed and off to bed to deep, dreamless sleep. In late November, the last time I drove up that bridge, I spied La Huita and swallowed the words, saying them only in my mind, not as an exclamation, but as a lament of something lost. I spied the men down below. They looked as if they were standing on water, on random amorphous bluffs, fishing in stark solitude. I wondered where the people fishing bought their bait, knowing that many of those small shops had been decimated by Hurricane Harvey. The simple sight of a man fishing seemed somehow triumphant in the wake of the tumult and chaos of recent storms and floods. My travel this time led me away from Port A and toward Rockport and Fulton, small conjoined twin towns bearing all of the sad markers of devastation. Rubbish piles lined the curbs and corners and streets, with few businesses open on what should have been a Saturday of bustling business. On one stretch of the road leading out of Rockport was a cardboard sign propped up on hay bales, an attempt at autumn decor. The Rockport Recovery and Relief Camps, next to a red brick home, though just miles from the water, felt landlocked, pressed in by makeshift tents and trucks that encircled the property. Dozens of live oaks on the homeowner's 3.5 acres looked like something out of Dr. Seuss. They suggested trees, but were no longer trees, not the same. The grayish trunks were familiar enough, but looked now more like giant hands reaching up in agony to the sky from the deep earth. Ripped away by the storm, every single bough and branch, every leaf shorn by the monster winds of every recognizable element of a live oak, left a kind of generic tree, a caricature, a grotesque shell of its former self rooted there among the fragile metal poles of dilapidated tents. As we approached the camp, the sound of children laughing surprised me, putting me both at ease and on my guard. A young woman, about 20 years old, in a tank top that revealed tattooing covering arms and shoulders, and on her back two large, intricate wings, inked in greenish-blue, pushed owlish glasses up the ridge of her nose and showed us around. Bees moved in and out of view, grazed my hair, and alighted on open cans of soda strewn on the tables that also held donated non-perishable food items, open bags of bread, crates full of produce. A downcast dog, a Labrador on a long chain next to his wire metal crate, moved only his eyes up to see our approach, and then looked back down. A shed bursting with large economy-sized packages of Pampers, wipes, and baby items was the center of the camp, where I saw young mothers pulling wagons and filling them silently, sadly, with the things they needed for their children. Makeshift showers reminded me of the outdoor shower where my siblings and I rinsed off the sand of Mustang Island, Beach Access Road 1A, all those years ago. But we had a warm shower inside the small house where we stayed after that, and privacy, and these folks didn't. The center of the camp included living room furniture, dusty sofas, and vinyl recliners where men smoked and drank sodas. A pregnant woman with a cigarette dangling from her lip emerged from a food truck with a cup of ramen noodles for one of the boys. A boy came up to me, shyly spying my camera. "Am I going to be on the news?" he asked. I nodded. He never asked me what station, channel, or newspaper I worked for, and of course he had no radio, computer, or TV to watch anything at all. Not cartoons or kid shows or the news. Nothing. "Hey," he called out to the other children at the camp, busy with their own invented games. "Come on, don't you want to be on the news?" "You are on the news," I thought. "I'm sorry, but you are on the news. You've been on the news. A number, a statistic, a faceless figure, a survivor, a displaced person waiting for FEMA or some other mercy." At a table with donated used shoes, two little girls tried on various pairs, even the larger adult shoes. The smaller girl balanced herself with one hand on the taller girl, who tried to force two small fuzzy bedroom ballerina slippers on her dusty feet. Chickens fluttered and squawked, chased by a little blonde boy with white chiclet teeth he'll grow into. "Am I going to be on the news too?" he asked. I nodded silently. "Watch me," he said, and he climbed on a bike too big for him, his tiny flip-flops barely reaching the pedals. "Watch me, look at me." It reminded me of how I battled waves on a red float, hoping my dad was filming me with a Super 8 camera from the water's edge. "Look at me," the pleading refrain of an innocent kid. I looked at the group of men and wondered if one of them was this boy's father. "Look at me," he said again, just before the bike slipped out from under him on the grassless, gravelly dirt. He didn't even wince or make a fuss, just climbed back on the bike and said, "Watch me." We made our way back to the truck. The wind had shifted, bringing in a cold front, and I could smell the salt air again as we drove off. I looked back only to see the blue tarps like large flags billowing there, the only canopy left among the leafless trees, like the waves of an ocean carrying us along.
Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavides is a writer and a professor of English at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.